We're called to order the House Revenue Committee today. I want to welcome in joint session with us the House Senate Revenue Committee as well. Good morning,
members.
And welcome our guests today, Tom Petoskey and Michael Kennedy in particular. Good to see you back with us. We have today the only thing on the agenda being the March 2003 revenue forecast. I know that we received some preliminary numbers on that, and I suppose the big picture today we'll get a chance to look at the methodology and the numbers behind the numbers, I guess, from Tom and Michael. So with that as our introduction, let's invite Tom Petoskey, state economist, and Michael Kennedy, revenue economist, to join us, and welcome and good morning.
Mr. Chair, don't let Mr. Petoskey open his umbrella inside the building, okay?
Okay. I asked him to move that stepladder that he was about to walk.
That's right. Who's that black cat that could have been?
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, no more coffee for Senator Corbin, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the House Revenue Committee, and members of the Senate Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petoskey, state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. With me also today is Michael Kennedy, also with the Office of Economic Analysis. Today we're releasing our March 2003 quarterly economic and revenue forecast. We release quarterly forecasts every year in the odd-numbered years during legislative sessions. Rather than the June forecast, we will be releasing the forecast on May 15th. To remind you about our process, we are assisted in this with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, 12 members from the business community, also from academia, to help us with special industry issues. We also have a DAS Economic Advisory Committee made up of people that use our results that we get data from that assist us in the forecast throughout agencies in the state government. And also, we also have the person from Metro, for example, also on the committee. So with that, I'm going to go quite quickly through the economic outlook that we have. It has changed a little bit so that we can get right away into the revenue issues behind the economic numbers.
Excuse me, Kathy, could you bring the lights down just a little bit, enough so the folks in the back of the room can still see theirs, but to help the projection. Thanks. Okay,
Okay, very briefly, as a reminder, we've been in front of the committees before describing our methodological process. We have an economic forecast. That economic forecast then feeds also into our revenue forecast. We have pre-meetings where we meet with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisor, discuss national issues, because we have a lot of national variables that do drive the Oregon economic model. We then do our simulations. We come back. We have a meeting with what we call insiders, which is the people in state government that I just alluded to. And then outsiders is the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, and we have all-day meetings with them. We finalize then the economic numbers. We meet. We review, we find out what we believe is happening with the revenue forecast, and thus the product you see before you today. I should mention that the hard copy that many of you are used to, I brought with me the December one. We don't have the blue-colored. In fact, it will still be blue-colored, but it will only be one color since double printing is not allowed now. So it'll have a little different texture to it than what we've seen in the past. But we felt that it was best to have that publication, which, as we speak, is being posted on our website, the entire document, rather than have the document all set and all the numbers finalized a week before so we could get it printed in time. We felt it made more sense to use all the time we could right up to the forecast and then have the document available on the web. The hard copy will be coming in a week to your offices. Business investment is important, both for U.S. and definitely for the U.S. We've talked before about the buildup that has occurred in business investments. Very strong, the fastest we've seen in the U.S. history, and then the great decline we've had. One bright point, we're seeing some stabilization out there, bottoming out of this investment. And we think that's a good sign, especially for Oregon. We are a state that is involved in making these type of goods, business investment goods. consumer sentiment. The February number, this is an estimate, as we speak, is being released by the University of Michigan. But it is down. It's not surprising it should be down because of all the geopolitical uncertainties that are out there right now. We are concerned about this. This does feed into, at times, consumer spending. Though the consumer has held up fairly well, even though it is an indication that things are softening. But once again, the indication, this is the last time we saw an incident that may be playing itself out again in the next couple of weeks. And we had quite a precipitous drop in that confidence. Federal funds rate, this is the rate that the Federal Reserve targets. Of course, we've seen it come down quite a bit. There was additional weakness in 2002. We had some further drops. But the expectation, and this is one that also falls into our model, there is a recovery coming. As that recovery comes, the Federal Reserve will also raise interest rates along the line. Recent news, recovery signal or double dip. We had a very weak estimate in gross domestic product in the economy, only a 0.7% increase. Our leading indicators have been up and down. Productivity has also been a little bit weak lately. Residential construction, this is one sort of bright area that we've gone through. That's also been bright for Oregon. And then finally down below, as I mentioned, the unemployment rate is lagging. The Oregon Employment Department releases today at 10 o'clock what the new unemployment rate will be for January, so we'll have to wait 45 minutes to find out what that's going to be. And consumer confidence, as I said, very some recent drops that have occurred because of the uncertainty.
Those are national?
These are national figures. And as I said, these national figures do play a role because they do feed into our Oregon model.
Right.
But the aspect here is that the view out there is that we are not headed for a double-dip recession. The highest probability of belief is that this is a sort of a jobless recovery. It's very weak, but we don't see it dipping back into recession. But unfortunately, this weakness, you know, some economists describe recessions by letters of the alphabet. You can have an L shape where you go in very deeply and you stay down. Some people believe this is the Japan situation. You can have a V shape, which we had in 1991. You get in fast and you come out fast. And this is very much a U shape. We've gone into it fairly rapidly, and we've been on the bottom for a while. And now we're looking for that recovery to bring us out of it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Senator Dicker.
Thank you. So what are the indicators that lead us to believe that we're not in a double digit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, we look at things like the leading economic indicators. They've been bouncing around. They haven't really dropped into an area or consistently have dropped where people believe that that's a indication that we are going into recession. This ISM index that I have up here is from the Institute of Supply Management. It looks at manufacturing. That has now gone above the 50 mark, which generally means that things should expand within the next 6 months. And so it's been bouncing around there. So a lot of the items are not lining up to tell us that we're headed for another recession. Not to say that it's not out of the realm of possibility. It's just that the probability of it occurring seems to be rather low. I'll allude to that once we get to our risk to their forecast because, you know, with the possibility of war with Iraq, how that plays out could possibly tip you into recession.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Petoskey, we've had a whole decade of experience in watching Oregon's economy be quite a bit more volatile and reactive to national trends. On the way up, that was great because Oregon's unemployment was below the national average and our growth in productivity outstripped national averages. It's not so great on the downside. Obviously, being designated ground zero for unemployment and for loss of economic power in our economy puts us considerably below on the curve of reduction. We may stay longer than the rest of the nation in recession. What are the indicators in other regional states, California, Washington, and elsewhere on the West Coast, that would lead us to believe that Oregon will come out? Are we seeing some strength in those other markets in the other states that give us some confidence that even though we're lagging behind the national trend, there is an upturn?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, we are seeing some aspects. I think in Oregon itself, we'll be talking, for example, about corporate profits. It appears that some of their business is picking up just marginally, because we are seeing just marginally some better in profits coming in. So I think those are indications that business isn't continuing to drop again. In terms of there are some unique conditions, for example, in Washington, where I think they may even be deeper in the recession than what we will be. Some unique things surrounding the aerospace airline industry, Boeing, that may keep them a little deeper into the situation than ours. California, if anything, California may start to benefit from a lot of defense contracts, and that can help them pick up, just as it really devastated them when the defense budget was really cut in the beginning of the 90s, and we saw the exodus from California coming up here. So there are signs nationally and I think locally that things are doing a little bit better. Exports for Oregon, they're almost up now by, I think, 13% over the year. The value of the dollar is coming down, and that's been advantageous, especially for our manufacturing sector. So there are some signs, but I want to keep in mind, as business starts to pick up, businesses don't want to make the mistake of hiring back people what they might see as too soon. So even though you start to see that start to pick back up again, you may not see any advantage on either employment growth, or you could even see the unemployment rate even creep back up a little bit. So in my mind, I think there's enough indicators out there that, you know, it's a jobless recovery, but we are in one. What we have to do is hopefully dodge these uncertainty bullets that are out there right now that are very, very large, that could cause even larger volatility. I will say for Oregon, and I've made this in speeches, we are a more manufacturing-based economy. And through business cycles, manufacturing is what really moves. It's very volatile. But over the time period, we probably have been a net gainer out of it, in that in the really good times, we gained on net more than other states. And, of course, right now, we're hurting more than most other states. But I think the net balance has still been positive for us. It's just that volatility is very painful at times.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For Oregon's economy, very quickly, the exports that I alluded to just a moment ago have been doing marginally better. Oregon employment growth, you see we're bouncing around this bottom line here. This is kind of our jobless recovery. As I said, we will know more once the Employment Department releases their data at 10 o'clock today, because also they are going back and they do this once a year. They re-benchmark. They have finally more data coming in, and they re-estimate, revise what their previous numbers were. And we'll see how then the story has shaped out once they have better data. Regionally, you can see the unemployment rate in the Portland metro area, lower in central Willamette Valley, coastal, southern regions, center and the eastern areas. These are not seasonally adjusted, as we've told you before. You generally will find higher unemployment rates out in these counties because this is the time of the year that they generally have higher unemployment because of the seasonal nature of the businesses out in those areas. What we generally have not seen in the past is how close the unemployment rates have been in this region, the more manufacturing-based, especially high-tech, relative to these other central and eastern counties, where we were more used to these being in between the 2.5% to 3.5% range rather than poking up towards 7%. And just an indication, too, of this sort of manufacturing-based recession. Flat growth in the economy. If we believe that this recession ended in January of 2002 and we've been in recovery, yet a very, very, very weak recovery, job gains 11 months running out to November are barely a 0.5% higher than they were at the beginning of the year. And generally in recoveries, as you can see, the 80-82 coming out of November of 82, by that time we were already 2.5% up on the year. And this is what we've generally seen in past recessions. We're playing out something somewhat similar to the 90-91, even though that was a little bit stronger than what we're seeing in this jobless one. Employment, we're expected, as the sign says up here, expected to grow faster in the U.S. after 2003, but a much slower growth. We had our, this is our V-type recession, where Oregon kind of skipped it, because this was more of your, what normally we've seen, more of the government type of engineered recession. It was a oil spiked one, energy problem, inflation type of recession. And we came into it out very quickly. This has been an investment-led recession, manufacturing-based, and we've hit deeper and a little bit sooner than the U.S. did, and a little bit more of that U-type shape to it. These are yearly numbers. But once again, we don't expect this high area of growth, and I'll allude back to that when I get to my slide on high-tech. Lumber and wood, we believe that's stabilizing out in 2003, but it's been a very, very difficult road for this sector. High-tech, we do believe it will resume growing, but at a much slower rate. This is an industry that is much more mature these days. It's not in the baby, in a sense, a baby boom type industry where we have new sightings, huge number of firms rushing in. It's more mature. And being more mature, we shouldn't expect to have a big bounce back of the type of boom period that we had in the mid-1990s. Construction, if you're doing single-family residential homes, life isn't too bad. Any other type of construction, other than some public works, it's a very, very tough going. Commercial, industrial real estate is still in the doldrums. Possibly office space won't, demand won't make up to capacity, possibly 2005, maybe in 2006. Per capita income, you can see over here that with the downturn in the Asian financial crisis and then continuing into the U.S. recession, we've lost ground again. And it's been a long, hard road. Comparison of some of our last forecasts. Once again, you know, there are risks associated with the forecast. We believe what is the most probable outcome. And our baseline forecast, is we believe, has the most likely outcome of occurring. But there's risks on the upside and downside. And what, unfortunately, we've been having are the downside risks are the ones that have been mostly coming true lately. We've consequently have revised our forecast down for 2003 in terms of employment growth since our September forecast to reflect this sort of stalling of the recovery, this lengthening out of this jobless recovery. Personal income growth, that also has been about the same amount as we've had in 2003. Partly as an adjustment from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. They do the measures for the states, and they revise their numbers up a little bit. So really, I see it as almost no change from our December forecast. But we believe going out, because of the delay in the recovery, that personal income has to be dropped from what we were seeing in our December forecast for 2004. Oops. To those risks I was talking about, as I said, there are upside risks. Things could turn out to be better than what our forecast is. There's also downside risk to that. And this is going to be a theme we hope we're going to provide you more and more analytical knowledge about these risks. Michael, in his presentation, will show you definite what we mean now, I think, in a more clear aspect of what we've been saying for years about the risks around the forecast. We think it is high time, and we're doing it now, giving you actual boundaries around those risks to give you hopefully better information on your planning. Congress and the Federal Reserve, I think possibly, if anything, there's an upside risk to this. Oregon could actually see more spillover effects from what's happening in terms of federal government changes and the Federal Reserve low interest rate area. Geopolitical, I think the downside risk is more worrisome at this point. And geopolitical carries a whole area of issues. You have the possible war with Iraq. How will that play out? Our model basically has worked into it a war scenario that is over relatively quickly, 5 to 6 weeks, and thus there is a bounce back that occurs from that. That means that things like oil prices, which are now starting to approach $40 a barrel, once a war is declared, will probably go above that level. But if it's quick and over, and indications are it's over, just as the anticipation, we haven't had a war yet, the anticipation has pushed it up, the anticipation that the war would be over soon will push it back down quite nicely into probably the low 20s. And that could happen very quickly. If, though the risk, what if it's a prolonged war? It isn't over in 5 weeks. It's 5 months or 6 months that it takes. That could keep those energy prices up there higher, and those prices work into the cost of business. And then you can get into your stagflation situation, where you get prices going up, businesses activity going down. And that is, it's not put as a high probability, but we have to recognize that is a risk out there. Energy prices. I was very hopeful of this in the past, that the market prices had come down quite dramatically. The problems that had occurred in terms of the Enron trading have been revealed. They're dealing with it. We had not a bad winter last year. Hopefully, as these forward contracts that people like PGE were in would come due, they'd recontract at lower rates. We saw them coming in front of the public utility commissions asking for lower rates. It was a good scenario. Now we see this winter with a low snowfall, another El Nino year, we could be back to a very dire situation. And Bonneville Power Administration, worried about covering their debts, needing to raise their rates, which also get passed on. So we are a little more concerned about the situation in terms of we don't think it's going to cause a recession for the Oregon economy, but once again, it's another factor that could stall out the recovery, make it last, that bottom last longer. Stock market, in the past, we'd had always seen the stock market rapidly going up as we were about ready to give our forecast, and we'd give our forecast, and the next day it would drop by hundreds of points. This time they're decided to change that pattern, and they're dropped by hundreds of points, even though it's been up for the last 2 days. I think they've been trying, they didn't realize we're going to release today, and they just found out, and so they're trying to make up for lost time. But as we know, the risks are out there. I really think the corrections, we will see 100-point movement days easily over the next few months. But the expectation is also in our model that we will not have a huge another correction in the stock market, although we're not also going to see a huge run-up either. Corporate reporting, I think this is possibly I could change this downside risk to even mild rather than moderate. The accounting rules have changed. They're being very proactive on this. SEC is doing a better job. So I think that we are going to miss the real hit on this part. So I don't think this is going to be as big of an issue as it was before. State and local government is, of course, a very big issue. We do have a mixed economy. We don't have a separate private sector and a separate public sector, and the two do not intertwine. And if you lower one, you do not affect the other. They are intertwined. And just as we're seeing now, state and local governments are latecomers to recessions. The collections of revenues and so on happen at a later time. The ability to then sit down and do the painful aspects of how do I either raise more revenues or I cut services, that takes time through a political process. We are seeing this as a latecomer to the recession. It is a drag on the recession, and no matter what you do. Raising taxes is a drag on an economy. We know that just from the federal aspect. We don't expect our federal government to raise taxes in a recession because that's harmful to the economy. We expect them to increase spending and to lower taxes possibly. But they can deficit spend. By the Constitution, they're allowed to do that. By a state's constitution, you're not allowed to do that. You almost have to do, unfortunately, the opposite of what's needed. And so whether you raise taxes or cut services, it is a drag on the economy. High-tech industry, very volatile industry. As I said before, though, it is a more mature industry, so we expect the bounce back that's going to occur is not going to be as strong as we saw in the mid-1990s. There are some signs that PC sales are up. The semi-book-to-bill ratio is settling down a little bit, showing what is coming in terms of bookings, what's going out in orderings. We're seeing some positive news from some of the semiconductor providers, like Novellus. They also are a little bit brighter on the future, believing that we're finally trying to see some turnaround in high tech, either the second half of this year or in 2004. The risk is that we've heard these statements before. If you keep saying them, they're bound to come true. But it does, at least this time around, seem to be a little bit more stronger statements than we have heard in the past. At some point, business investments, the high-tech needs, the information technology needs, they do wear out. They do need to be replaced. The new technology that does come from the chips, they do finally get the new software. There are productivity gains by going to all this new equipment, and eventually they will do so. It's just that because of the uncertainty, they're sitting on the sidelines now. And with that, I can take maybe a couple questions on the economy before
questions
turning over.
Questions on the economic forecast? No? All right. Please, let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the House and Senate Revenue Committees, for the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. We've got a number of big issues to cover here. And what I'd like to start off with is some of the efforts we've been making in the past few months to address our models and performance issues. If you'll remember, recently this year, earlier, we met and discussed the methodology, and one of the primary points that came out of that was that these models were developed in the early 80s, and except for some incremental revisions, were pretty much the same as they were then. And I think two of the major issues there are that at that point, you had far less information available from which to work, and two, the underlying tax base, the structure of our economy, was different, and those models reflect that. And so what we've been doing is actually making efforts to revise these, bring them significantly forward, and here I'm just going to address one particular instance of that. What we've done is construct, I have revised up here because it's based upon the same tenets as the existing models, but really it's to reconstruct from the ground up a model of taxable income and liability for Oregon for personal income tax. And what we've done here is to focus, given new data that we've had recently from Department of Revenue dating back to 1980, is to focus on the major components of gross taxable income. Now, this is an extension of what Paul instigated by bringing in capital gains into the model. It was to recognize that personal income was really starting to not track very closely with taxable income. This is just an extension on that to recognize that there are a number of other components of income that are not tracking with personal income as well. And we'll see specific examples of that on the next slide. But in general here, very quickly, the point here is to relate each of these components to underlying economic variables that we have in our economic model or the national economic model, tie them to those explicitly, see the relationships, and then to forecast those components of income separately going forward. And then using a historic trend in effective tax rate, you then can compute a liability number, which are the dollars that you will eventually get as tax collections. Liability here is the heart of the entire revenue forecasting process. If you get liability forecasted within reason, you're going to have a much better revenue forecast going forward, and that is our objective here. Just to show some general summary statistics on this, which point out two points, here you first can see the eight components that we're looking at. Wages, dividends and interest separately. You can see the capital gains, which we had been tracking throughout the 90s. And you can see there, going from 1987, 4% of gross taxable income to 8.9%, there is your motivating factor for looking at those explicitly, because they were a driving factor underlying our 1990s increase in tax revenues. Retirement income,
proprietorship. Schedule E is rents, royalties, and S-corp income. And other, which is primarily unknown income. If the Department of Revenue can't tie an Oregon return back to a federal return, they don't know what the components of income are. But it's a fairly, as you can see, it's not very large, and it doesn't really drive much in what we're looking at. There's also unemployment, alimony income in there. It's a hodgepodge of things. The first two columns here, what's important to notice is how our tax base has changed. If you notice, in 1987, wages were 72.5%. That has dropped to just below 65%. Now, wages are a very stable source of income, much more stable than some of the others. So right there you're seeing one of the drivers behind the increased volatility is that we are moving towards other sources of income that are more volatile. In particular, capital gains, as we've seen going from $6 billion in 1 year to $3 billion in the next. I mean, that's an extreme case. But you will get some of the same volatility in, say, Schedule E with your S-corp, which is, you know, small corporation earnings, which tend to be fairly volatile. And that source has gone up there from 1.7 to 4.3%. So you're adding potential for volatility in the taxable income base.
Michael, I got a question about the percent of totals for 2000 on there. Of course, 2000, I think, corresponds to right up toward the top of the graphs that we saw in the economic forecast. Do you have any intuitive sense of how those? We know capital gains is down as far as its share. Do you know how these other numbers may be moving around? It's still going to equal 100%. So where have the changes have been? Where have the changes been?
Mr. Chair, we actually have 2001 data. We've just received it. I put this up here really to show the exaggerated. But for 2001, it's very similar to what you see up there, except capital gains is back down to 4%. You still have retirement income up where it is now, because that is, among all those, a fairly stable component. And actually, I'll get to that when I talk about the next two columns. But if the sense, it's primarily very similar to that, except for the capital gains. The next two columns I've put up there, because this really is the heart of your forecast changes for this March 2003 forecast. I mean, this is the first time we've developed this model and looked at all of these components specifically, and it was a very, very insightful exercise to have to justify the future in terms of each of these components and say, why do you think they're going to grow at the rate they're going to grow? In the model, they are actually tied to economic variables. So rather than having just gross income sort of tied to generic, you know, personal income statistics and saying, well, in the future, you know, it's probably going to grow this much because in the past it's grown this much, say a little bit less. In this case, you're actually going component by component and justifying based upon demographics, employment, population, your forecast for market values, et cetera. So it's a much more rigorous exercise. And when we did that, I mean, you can see now to compare the historical growth rates during those boom years, you can see nearly 8% growth in gross taxable income. And that is being driven by, as you can see, capital gains, a retirement income growing significantly. But there again, you have basically your pension plans tied to the stock market to some degree, so you're also getting some increases there in the total dollars. And then you have the baby boom generation approaching, so you have more and more retirees. So that's fed into that. As you can see, Schedule E, I think your S-corp, income growing at that rate is just tied to much of the same things that were driving our overall economy. Those small businesses are probably located somewhat in the manufacturing sector, in the high-tech sector, perhaps consultants or whatever. And the other income not only grows by that much because that other unknown component fluctuates around from year to year. It's pretty much just dependent upon whether they're able to match Oregon returns to federal returns, and that for some reason is different from year to year, but that's as much as I know there. But as you can see going forward out to 2009, our growth rate for gross taxable income is down to 4.2%. Mm-hmm. And that's significantly moderated from previous. Going through this component by component really did result in an entirely different picture of the future and a justification for liability, for income and thus liability. And we'll see now when we get into the forecast numbers how those impacts played out.
Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Kennedy, when you tried
when you made the changes that you made, did you go back in time as well and see if you had taken those into account in previous forecasts that it would have made a difference in your ability to forecast?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I didn't go back specifically and do the kind of exercise you're talking about. Intuitively, this particular model is going to be more pertinent for future biennium, because what you're really talking about is a story about the long-term trends here, whereas talking about the immediate impacts, changes in an annual liability changing around aren't going to be as relevant for what you're talking about now, which is what's going to happen the next 8 months and now down to 4 months of the biennium, where more of what you're looking at there are the actual collections themselves and trying to tie that back to what's going on in the tax system, et cetera. But in particular, there are a few instances here where possibly you would have gotten a better read. And as I'll point out here in a second, there's still issues with this methodology, as there always will be with forecasting. As a matter of fact, I'll get to those right now. The benefit of this, as I've said, is that you've tied these specifically and in great detail to economic factors, so you have a much more detailed relationship there. And it forces you to really assess your forecast in the future by component, what's going to change, population, you know, specific components of income, rather than just a generic story. Well, this is reasonable growth rate, so there you have it. But there are still some issues here. For one, the data lag that I've discussed before. The last gross taxable income data we have is for 2001, and we just received that, because it generally takes a year for the Department of Revenue to receive all tax returns and to process them, clean up, take care of issues, particularly because of extensions. It was this last October that they received most of the final returns for tax year 2001. So the important point here is that 2002 is a forecast. We're already past it, but it is still a forecast in the model. And then as well, I mean, there's a very good historical fit with a lot of the underlying variables, particularly the wages equation, which is explained almost 100%. There's a very close tie with the underlying variables. Unfortunately, going forward, you're using forecasts of those variables to create a forecast of revenue. So any error in those forecasts is going to feed directly through. I mean, you're never off the hook. There's no certainty in any variable you're going to throw into an equation that's going to allow you to forecast anything else perfectly.
But to go back to Senator Corcoran, an interesting question, I guess, could you take this out for a test drive and go back to 2 years where the numbers are settled and apply the forecast as of the earlier year, say 1999, to forecast 2001? I mean, is that the question? Could you go back and say, okay, applying this to what we knew in 1999, does it give us a better picture of what actually happened in 2001, and does that tell us whether this system gets us closer to the mark? Is that what you're after?
And I was, you know, specifically looking, for instance, at the retirement numbers.
Yeah,
right.
All
yeah.
Anecdotally,
right.
There's all these assumptions about the demographics and all the stuff that's happened with FERS, but of course the retirement income up. But I suppose you could anticipate that some of that retirement would take place out of state. I don't know. It just seemed like it'd be interesting to see how you could look back and see if it helped shine up your crystal ball.
Mr. Chair, what you're going to see there is exactly this dependence on those underlying forecasts. What you'll see is, in this case, if anything else, when you go forward and you look back and you were off by some degree, you're going to be able to say more explicitly exactly why, what underlying assumption about those variables, say demographics or the stock market, really cause you to be off.
So, Michael, if I get this, this won't necessarily make us more accurate. We'll know better why we were wrong.
Mr. Chair, to some degree, I do believe that it will improve the accuracy, but there's a very real difference here between improving it, being off by 5% either way rather than 7.5%, and eliminating it entirely. I do believe, and there's a number of other things we are doing currently that really do more to discuss the turning point issue, which is what this would not get at. If you're running along with an economic forecast that says, oh, things are fine and we're growing, you would have run right by 2001 as much as you did now.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Yes, I'd like to follow up on the retirement issue. Do you really feel that you know enough about the retirement issue and its impact in Oregon to really make it a significant part of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, in fact, it is fairly stable over time. So whatever the issues are, there seems to be some stabilization factors in there, in particular because demographics are very stable. We do have a state demographer who looks at all of the various issues going into the makeup of our population and has a forecast. I mean, that's easily going into the model is better than not having it there. You're getting additional insights. For 2001, what's interesting is while a number of these other components dropped, particularly capital gains, wages stagnated, retirement was the one that stayed closest to its historical growth rate. It grew at 2.5% in 2001 relative to 2000. Now, that was well under the growth rate you've seen historically, but it still was more resilient than any of the other components of income. So there's reason to believe, actually, that that's going to be one of our saving graces rather than a problem going into the future. And, in fact, as you saw, it has the highest growth rate going forward because the underlying drivers are far more stable. You've got income supports via Social Security. Most pension plans were managed at least a little bit better than the average person in the stock market. So, yeah, you had declining balances, but the actual impact on your monthly distribution was less than what you actually saw in terms of the total stock market correction. So there are reasons to believe here that it will be fairly stable going forward and improve the accuracy of the model.
Representative Hans.
Thank you. Just one quick question, comment on these forecasts. Would it make more sense to put these forecasts in a range, say within $100, $200 million? Because I know a few weeks ago, Tom, when you had a preliminary warning, you said, here's the worst case and here's the best case. And I think it was prudent and responsible for some of us to start planning for your worst case. And it turned out to be even a little bit worse than your worst case, I think. And so it just seems to make sense because so much of what we do with the kicker and planning and reserves depend upon these forecasts. And it just seems like if you put them in a range, it makes it easier to manage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, that is exactly correct. And honestly, should have been happening prior to now. I mean, it really is when you make a forecast, you're really forecasting a scenario around a most likely case, but what your forecast really is some probabilistic outcome around that, and that's really what you need to be making decisions on, not based on one number that has very little likelihood of being the exact number that's ever going to happen. We have modified our presentation here to take those into account, as you will see.
If I might add, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, for a long time in the office there was a debate about doing this and a feeling that how many numbers do you want have floating out there, and shouldn't just give people one number that they can concentrate on. And I think now, with the volatility we've seen now, that approach was not correct. If there is going to be some confusion around a set of numbers, well, it's our job to make it more clear to you what that exactly means. And that's what we're proposing to do from now on.
Good. Okay. I want to keep in mind, I guess you're scheduled for Ways and Means in 5 minutes. We'll probably delay Ways and Means, but we'll try and let you move forward here.
Very quickly, what have we seen in the last 3 months since we met in December that has produced changes in our forecast? In terms of personal income tax collections, as you can see, the green line is withholding. Actually, in the last 2 months, has gotten up above zero marginally. But in fact, and just to extend this point, in December's forecast, withholding was expected to actually tick up fairly well in the first two quarters based upon an expectation of 3% employment growth in both those quarters and 5% personal income growth. That's not materialized, and consistent basically with the underlying scenario of the worst case, and we're now saying flat for the rest of the year. that's more reasonable than continuing just to push off some recovery one quarter, two quarters. It's looking like that's far riskier assumption. And so right now the forecast actually assumes flat withholding growth. I'll get into that a little more. The drop there in total receipts corresponds to the drop in estimated payments that were made for the fourth quarter. Relative to the forecast for the fourth quarter, which was both December and January, it was down about $60 million relative to the forecast and down significantly compared to the previous year. So it was an unanticipated and uncharacteristic drop. I suspect that with the stock market taking 1,000-point dive in December, that potentially there could be some losses that were taken there that fed into the calculations. It's just a preliminary sort of read on my part.
Michael, then are we assuming that that decline, especially in the estimated payments in December and January, will that carry forward into, folks are anticipating then what their final 2002 tax liability is going to be, so I would expect that we will see that carry forward into the final payments in April, and if folks use 2002 as their safe harbor for establishing the rate of estimated payments for 2003, is that why you're looking at basically flat? Because I imagine unless they see their income going up, they're not going to increase those estimated payments until maybe September at the earliest, or even December or January, as they start to see how the year shakes out.
Mr. Chair, that is exactly correct. And right after I present this biennium's forecast, we're going to go into detail into the risk, and that gets exactly at the heart of what you're talking about. On a slightly positive side, as Tom already made note, corporate profits appear to be showing some signs of reversing this almost two-year-long bout of negativity. And in fact, that last little dip there in October, you see, is the refund period. It's the final for most corporations, the reconciliation. So what it looks as if you see, real-time profit deterioration there for a number of periods. You see that sort of end, and then what you see is this last lagging impact of losses carried forward and refunds being high. It's our guess that that may well mark the end of at least the negative, the slide in corporate profits. We're not expecting anything to tick up significantly. And in fact, as you'll see, the forecast is flat. It's not changed because we're not reading this into the future and saying, oh boy, it's all over. We're off.
Paul remarked on the scale of that graph, and that is pretty remarkable.
In fact, I tried to look back. The 2001 figure is purely a function of two very small numbers that go slightly in the opposite direction, that when you then take the ratio of the year-over-year change, it's just dramatic. But it's not at, there's no dollar sitting there.
Yeah.
It's like negative 200 and positive 2,000, which is nothing, or 2 million scale. And so it results in that, even though it really was inconsequential for us.
Thank you for that reassurance.
Ancient history. So here is the 0103 forecast now for March. And as you can see, and as you've probably heard before, it is down. And that is entirely the result, this 9.34 number, which is now the total resource number, which includes beginning balance. You have about an 8.9 number for just revenues. So that's down compared to a 9.222 number that we'd provided before. So the difference here is about $245 million, and that is entirely driven by the personal income tax for reasons we've just discussed, plus ones I will discuss additionally here shortly. As you can see, corporate is flat, even though we've seen some strength there. The risks here of energy prices going up and eating into profits is a definite risk, and so we basically felt it wasn't reasonable to just jump on the bandwagon on 3 months' worth of information. So that forecast has remained stable. Consider those 3 months of above forecast numbers as sort of just a cushion there for this very uncertain time going into at least the global situation. And other funds, most of that, there is an increase in insurance taxes. In fact, Oregon gets a considerable amount of dollars from the retaliatory tax on foreign insurers, and that's based on a relative corporate income tax. So it's the only bright side here, but because ours have deteriorated, foreign insurers actually owe us more money in insurance taxes. So a slight little bit of comfort there, slight. It's about $6 million increase in this forecast versus the last. So the question that we've heard and that you probably have is, why should we believe this forecast since for the last six quarters you've presented a forecast and then it's been down subsequently? And the answer is, well, that particular number, no, you shouldn't believe that number as we've just discussed. Now I want to get into exactly what are the immediate risks and what really is a range that those constitute or create. As we've said, well, there's 5 months of withholding remaining, and we have basically flattened that out now. There's very little growth. Be aware, however, that for March, the withholding tables changed to reflect the Measure 88 delay. So, in fact, in 2002, those withholding tables did not actually reflect the change from 5,000 to 3,250. So, in fact, in theory, there was too little withholding there in 2002. It's a minor upside risk here going forward. Those change tomorrow. And we will see those for 4 months impacting our withholding. So you will see a slight growth there for the next two quarters. It's purely based on that and not on any underlying economic assumption. Two more estimated payments. And, in fact, about 12% of estimated payments on the prior tax year are made at tax time, as people who find themselves in a position of not having paid enough can at least avoid penalties. So you have actually 2.5 estimated payments between now and the end of the biennium. In this forecast, the December forecast had fiscal year 2003 estimated payments being roughly 5% higher than 2002. They're now 5% below 2002. That in part reflects that $60 million loss in actuals, plus then exactly what you were talking about, which is bringing down those estimated payments, in particular because of that safe harbor method. And that actually feeds into the next consideration. We still have here the 2002 tax year final reconciliation, the 2003 tax season. And what we've discovered actually recently is a very tight relationship between the change in liability, the percent change in liability, and how and what the distribution between refunds and final payments is. It's actually much closer than I would have thought. Previously, we were saying, well, it dropped significantly between 2000 and 2001, and that's why we saw this huge outflow of refunds last year. The split was about 70-30. And now we've said, well, we don't have dropping liabilities, so we expect it to be more normal. Well, in fact, flat liability still implies that there's going to be more refunds than normal, and that is built into this forecast. It's right now it's about, as you can see, 64-36. Which is still well below the 45-55 that you would see in a normal growth year. Still, that is where a lot of the variability lies. That could go either way, in particular because of the withholding table issue. We could be underestimating liability, and we could see more final payments than refunds than we're currently expecting. On the other hand, we saw 70-30 last year, and that is still possible. We will not know until well into April when we see this panning out. And that is virtually all of your variance there. If you look at all three of those and you say, what is the likelihood they could be worse, try to remember that past forecasts always had built into them some expectation of we're going to come out of this, because historically recessions have lasted two or three quarters, and then eventually you see, and we've been sitting here now for six quarters saying, well, then the next one, then. This forecast does not have any expectation of a return for the remainder of this biennium. That's a very real difference. When you're talking about downside risks now versus previous forecasts, you're going from a failure to realize some gain, some improvement, to now basically looking at something would have to happen. You would have to have some kind of catastrophic event that would decrease withholding significantly, or that, in fact, somehow our read on 2002 liability was just very different.
So basically, short of that kind of catastrophe, you've tried to wash out all of the downside out of this forecast. Is that
245 million went a long way to Mr. Chair.
Michael, I see Ken Rocco in the back of the room wondering where you are. Well, let's put this on overdrive, and we'll get you down to Ways and Means in a few minutes.
The $100 million here, we think, is, when we say 90% likelihood, we're recognizing that you can never cover all your bases unless we just say, you know, all the remaining dollars from zero to double that. That would be your 100% range. But here, in all likelihood, you will not see a change in the forecast, May or actuals, greater than $100 million either way.
Just to make certain that I understand, what you're saying is that there's a 5% chance on either end that you could be wrong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly how this works out.
Okay, thank you.
And that is going to be true of any range we give. That is the issue, as we'll see. Very quickly, I've shown this before. We went and looked at the close of session forecasts for the entire period there were close of session forecasts versus actuals, and have looked at then the variance of the forecast versus actuals. And as you can see here, two negative episodes, both related to recessions, and otherwise positive errors, that is actuals coming in above the forecast. The average here is about 1.6%, so a slightly conservative forecast over time. Of course, this number of observations is very small. All right, making statistical inference off 11 observations is fairly tricky. But in fact, the standard deviation here is about 7.3 percentage points. What you'd be saying here is that going forward, if you had a close of session forecast, that roughly 70% of the biennials you ever experienced, the difference in actuals versus that forecast would fall within 7.3 percentage points either way. A very important point to note, however, is that that's driven completely by the 10.6 upside in 95-97, mm-hmm. Corresponding to the unanticipated run-up in the stock market and our high-tech manufacturing employment, wage rates, et cetera, and this 16.1% we're currently in.
So it's a standard deviation, but it's not a predictable deviation.
Mr. Chair, this is the point that even this is a forecast.
Yeah.
Even this is to look back,
yeah,
and say what's normally happened. We're projecting what it will be. When I look at that, I say you've got a very unique circumstance in 95-97, and you've got an associated negative swing from that for this binding.
Well,
those are not
the
normal.
State economist in 95 and 96?
Yeah. What the heck?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yeah,
what you're really saying, isn't it, is that you're not any better at predicting turns than anyone else is. Isn't that really what you're saying?
Mr. Chair,
you want to rephrase that?
Representative Barnhart.
I don't mean to be derogatory, because that's not the point of the question. I mean, economists through the ages have been unable to say that the trend that we're on now is going to change on X date.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly correct. That is the tough part to call. And that's where you would focus a lot of your efforts to improve a forecast.
Right. Right.
In particular, would be leading indicators that would allow you to then see this coming. In particular, the whole refund final ratio, just in few weeks that I've done the work, literally going backwards, we could have called, knowing what we know now, what I've modeled now, could have called at least the $350 million that went out last April, as early as the December prior, rather than reporting it as a fact come June. There is one of your efforts in mining through the data and coming up with this, is to see that you actually have information that's out there that can tell you things. You just need to clue into that relationship and then remember it going forward and be prepared to see the signs. One of the things this has done for us, since it's unique in at least the period we have data, is it's now at least given us the experience. Most of the problem was, if it's unprecedented, you have no reason to think of it beforehand. Why should I think that this is going to approximate, you know, three times the length of a normal recession when I haven't seen that in 50 years since the Great Depression?
Michael, again, I hate to keep our joint Ways and Means folks. That's a lot of people down there waiting. Can we just jump to the general fund 0305 and
absolutely
finish with that? We'll get the full report here.
And in fact, the whole issue there surrounding the range, you will now see we're forecasting $10.4 billion compared to roughly 9, so about 468 difference. And that really is tied into that change in the liability model. And a realization that Oregon has some potential real problems down the road with its manufacturing sector, with public drag things, and saying those are very real possibilities. So you can see down at the bottom here, we have added exactly what you've addressed. What I was saying before is I don't think that 7.3 is reasonable going forward because those were unique circumstances. If you take those two out, you get roughly a 4.1%. So that's in normal times. So somewhere in there. And your 6% rule of thumb, which obviously didn't apply during unique times, is still probably a very good rule of thumb going forward. We put both of the implications up there. So with the fairly normal times, you would see no more than, say, a $425 million.
Other questions? I'm inclined to wrap this up so we can get them down to the other end. Yeah,
just one very quick one. If I understand those numbers correctly, what you're really telling us is that your minimum variance confidence level at the 90% level is about 8%. About approximately 2 standard deviations or slightly less than that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it would be about 95% would be associated with 2 standard deviations. Exactly.
Slightly around 8% would be around 2.
And that's 2.5% on either side, so you're really talking about 97.5% above that.
Right?
Only 2.5% probably you would be below that. Exactly.
But your numbers are not.
Our numbers are 1 standard deviation is what I've put up there. That should encompass if you take 70% and say it's 15 on either side, you're talking 85%.
Right.
And really, you're outside. There are your more unlikely risks going forward.
Thank you.
All right. There's the address for more information for members that want that. Michael and Tom, I want to thank you. This has been a rough week for you guys, I know, and I know in the press, too, statements even some attributed to me in expressing lack of confidence. I want to make sure on the record that is not those are not statements directed to you or critical of either of you individually or your staff. You've got a tough job, and I think our concern is just the recognizing how hard it is to predict a monster as big as this economy with all of the variables that feed into this. So I want to express that in terms of our personal confidence in your good work and abilities that's not at all an expression of any lack of confidence in you individually. It reflects more the process and the system and just the nature of the job. Like we've talked about that before, driving the car from the trunk looking backwards. And that's the job that you've got to do. And I want to say on the record that we appreciate and understand that. So thank you for that and the chance to say that. Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that I think I've solved our problem with the Senate. You just simply have to sit me down in the middle of them.
And they go away.
They solve the problem.
All right. With that, committee, please note that we have a special session probably Monday afternoon at 3:30. It will be just for bill introduction. As you know, Monday is our last day to introduce bills, and I'm getting several requests for committee bill introductions, some of which may not be ready until the afternoon. So if need be, we will recess the Monday morning meeting until 3:30. If we can get a quorum just to get some last bill introductions.
We need a quorum for that.
We'll need a quorum for that. Yep. All right, with that, folks, thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.